I'm Linda von Tilburg for BizNews, and with me is Mark Bertschalt. He's the founding director of Omba Advisory and Investments, a company that has a unique approach to investing, and they focus on exchange trade funds or ETFs. Hi, Mark. Welcome again to BizNews.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
So why this focus on ETFs?
Well, we've had this conversation before, but there's obviously been a tremendous boom over the last many years, if not decades, in the use of exchange-traded funds to build portfolios. For us, they're just a fantastic tool, and we think of them as a tool to build a portfolio. There are lots of different types of ETFs. There are traditional ones that track major indices. You now get active ETFs. You get other ones which have got sort of some sort of clever way of reweighting an index, so smart beta or factor ETFs. You've got thematic ETFs which have boomed. But the way we think about using them is in an active way. So although they're a passive instrument that track an index, we are active managers that use ETFs as our tool to build portfolios of differing risk profiles with different strategies. And so, for example, in fixed income, we might express a view on keeping our interest rate risk or duration short or long or neutral. You might want to take more credit risk and own high yield or emerging market debt, for example, and you can do all that with ETFs. You might want to have a different currency exposure for your fixed income. In equities, we might use, you know, ETFs in different sectors, for example, where we want to have a sector view or a sector overweight or underweight or a country overweight or underweight or a particular theme. You know, lots of interesting themes in the world today, whether it's cybersecurity, robotics, AI, cloud computing, e-commerce, clean energy and the decarbonization and transition to a cleaner world. There's so many products available and at your disposal. And even more recently, you now got active ETFs, which are basically similar to a traditional active mutual fund. But instead of having a daily dealing, they trade on an exchange and they're actively managed and they follow a strategy. But they're exchange traded funds as opposed to funds that trade with a daily NAV. So the boom in ETFs with over 8,000 ETFs in the world for us presents an opportunity to use those as a tool to build portfolios, where inherently our portfolios will always be more diversified because we're not taking big concentrated single bond or single stock risks. And we think that affords investors some level of comfort in avoiding single stock or single bond blowups in a portfolio. Of course, your market risk exists, but your single stock or single bond risk has been removed.
Well, let's talk about market risks. The world economy is still in a squeeze. So what should investors be looking out for?
Well, for us, I think, you know, not just us, I guess most investors around the world follow interest rate cycles and inflation as one of the key drivers of what will impact the outlook for markets. And, you know, the US has been surprisingly robust. You know, if you go back, you know, 6 or 12 months, everyone was talking about this imminent recession from the US because interest rates moved up over 5% in quite a short period of time, having had a zero rate environment for a long time post the financial crisis. And so that big move up in interest rates was expected to squeeze the economy more, but it hasn't. So, you know, employment data remains pretty robust. You know, in the US, the economy has been growing in sort of G10 world at the fastest rate of 3%. So the US has actually so far engineered a soft landing. Inflation is one of the concerns because inflation hasn't come in to the degree that everyone would have expected by now based on where interest rates are. A lot of that's been driven by what's happening in the shelter component of inflation. And, you know, one of those components is owner's equivalent rent. And the owner's equivalent rent makes up a big portion of core, you know, in terms of CPI. And that's for various dynamics that are taking place in the US housing market, one of which is obviously a decrease in supply versus number of people entering the country. So I think the US population's grown by about 30 million people since 2008. And they haven't built enough homes per annum, I think sort of 600,000-700,000 per year. So you've got a supply issue, but then you've also got the interest rates effect that, you know, a lot of the mortgages in the US are fixed long-term mortgages, which is sort of new in terms of how it was versus pre-global financial crisis. They learned their lesson. You know, all these floating rate mortgages caused the subprime issue and the big blow up in the housing market. Now, post that period, most buyers of a property will have a 20 or 30 year fixed mortgage. And those rates have risen to over 7%. And so people who want to potentially move home would have to lock in a much higher rate than what they currently pay. I think average rates now across sort of mortgages in the market are about 3.8% or sort of just sub 4. So that's meant that people haven't been selling homes. So there aren't many homes available in the sort of, you know, second-hand home market, let's say, where, you know, people who have an existing home are selling and they're downsizing. So a lot of the baby boomers that traditionally, as their kids would have grown up, might downsize and sell their big house. They're not doing so because they're going to have a high mortgage cost. And so this dynamic in the housing market has meant that this component, owner's equivalent rent, which is only done as a survey every 6 months, has caused inflation to remain sticky. I think two-thirds of inflation number that we saw, sort of 3.8% last month, was driven by this rental component. And so although you've seen inflation come in, and that's good news, it hasn't come in to the degree the Fed would have wanted. And so the broader thinking in the world is that the Fed are likely to stay on hold with higher rates for longer. Whereas if you rewind to the beginning of the year or late last year, everyone is expecting, you know, a number of cuts already by now and certainly by the end of the year. So for us, watching this inflation number and the Fed reaction is very, very important because, you know, easier monetary policy and lower rates boosts an economy for the simple reason that people aren't servicing as much debt. So that's one of the key things for us in terms of what we're watching very closely, because trying to understand that inflation dynamic and how it'll impact the Fed's actions is probably driver number one. But there are lots of things we watch all over the world.
So what are the other countries you're watching? I looked at the UK and inflation is also a bit sticky there. It hasn't come down as much as they thought. And can we also talk about China?
Sure. So very, very different economies. The UK is, you know, has got a little bit of a higher level of inflation. It's certainly higher than expected. But the Bank of England is still expected to cut rates probably in June. They've indicated as such. Similar with the ECB in Europe, likely to cut rates. So outside of the US, if you look at G10, many of the major central banks are likely to do their first cut in the middle of the year because inflation has been coming in. And, you know, one of the drivers of potential decline in prices, obviously, we had the spike in inflation due to energy prices rising post the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians. That caused a bit of a wobble. You know, supply-demand balances have fixed themselves now. But China is actually exporting, in a way, deflation because, you know, they've got no inflation at all. And so that's good for the rest of the world that buy Chinese goods because they're not having to pay more for them. All the issues we had from supply chain problems when China were locked down and not being able to, for example, finish a new car because some component was missing and you couldn't get it from China. It meant the car couldn't be finished, which meant that secondhand car sale prices shot through the roof because you couldn't get a new car because it wasn't finished. Those have now abated. And so China's opened up. In fact, their exports have boomed and the manufacturing sector is looking very strong. So China's definitely, you know, we've always at Omba liked having a greater APAC weight because of economic activity taking place, not just in China, but throughout the APAC region. But China is one of the regions where we're slightly overweight and we're comfortable maintaining that. You've obviously had a very meaningful slowdown during the lockdown period in China, but you're starting to see economic activity pick up. You know, the number of travelers traveling within China itself, traveling outside of China, the stock market activity that we've seen in the recent months from sort of Hong Kong investors investing into China has increased. The government have just come out with a whole host of reforms to boost the property market, which has slumped quite meaningfully. You know, everyone's talked about the Chinese property bubble. You know, it's already started to deflate. It hasn't been a GFC-style subprime disaster like we saw in the US. The government have intervened very cleverly to let the bubble burst slowly, but prices have fallen meaningfully. That's obviously hurt a lot of, you know, Chinese savers who traditionally save with second properties, etc. And they've now come out with a whole host of reforms to boost the property market, including getting local government to buy some of these properties, you know, for housing for their population. Also, you know, reducing the deposit amount required on a down payment for a property by 5% for the first home or a second home. So I think it's 15 and 25% deposit required, which is a drop from what it was before. They've dropped the lending standards in terms of allowing a low interest rate to be given on a mortgage. So there are all these stimulatory things happening in China. And a lot of foreign investors sort of capitulated in the last 12 to 18 months and said, we're out of China. It's not investable. We've pulled out. And I think we're going to likely see a comeback of many of those investors over the coming 6 to 18 months because valuations are so attractive. China's growing at over 5% per annum. And, you know, they're leading in all sorts of areas, whether that's, you know, battery technology or electric vehicles. Manufacturing's been picked up. The property market is stabilizing. So I think as we look at the world in terms of big regions where you could allocate capital, China's very much on our radar. We maintain a slight overweight, but it, you know, it's got its issues. I won't go through all of them, but yeah, you know, we're net positive on China.
So how would this growth in the Chinese market continue, especially in view of the pressure that the US is starting to put on China?
Now, in terms of geopolitics, I mean, obviously the tariffs that we've seen coming out of the US now, the Biden administration, you know, a lot of that you could argue is somewhat political. You know, Trump slapped on tariffs in his term, and now, you know, Biden's up against Trump, and so he put on a lot of tariffs. You know, a lot of that's to boost domestic production in the U.S. A lot of it's also political, in our view, you know, to some degree, to get voters on side. And it is an issue. You know, if the whole world stops buying from China, which is, in our view, never going to happen, or it becomes too expensive, that could be a bit of a knock. But China have also signed a number of bilateral trade agreements with other countries outside of the EU and the U.S. You know, I forget the exact numbers, but in terms of their trade agreements with Latin American countries, for example, some of the APEC countries and some of the African countries, their bilateral trade agreements mean that China don't only have to export their product to the US and Europe, which are the two major buying regions, but the rest of the world is also growing. And China is a meaningful player in that regard. You know, for us, it's a combination of, you know, looking at valuations and saying, are these stock prices attractive based on earnings growth? And then, you know, one of the big changes is, will Chinese companies start to declare more dividends so that you as a shareholder actually get your money back? You know, because historically, the dividends have been reinvested in growth of these businesses. And you've started to see a number of the companies, particularly some of the big internet and tech companies, do share buybacks and pay dividends. And we think that trend will continue. The Chinese savers are very different to many savers in the West, and in terms of thinking about their pensions and retirement. In the West, a lot of people would invest in the stock markets. And you've got often tax breaks in many countries around the world, as you'll know, in South Africa, UK, Europe, US, for saving into a pension or various savings vehicles. You don't have that to the same degree in China. And so if there was ever reform to boost savings into the stock market, you know, there's a huge scope for an increase in prices. But valuations are attractive. Geopolitics for us is always going to be there. China have become a dominant player in the world. They're the second largest economy. You know, the rhetoric around China will not change from the West. We tend to read only Western press in English, let's say, or maybe in South Africa, other languages. But the bulk of us read this press that's biased towards the Western view of China. If you read press from Southeast Asia or from, you know, maybe from Hong Kong, or, you know, just less Western-centric press relating to things happening in China, you don't necessarily glean this as pessimistic view. But the geopolitics will never go away. And it's interesting, just on that topic, I was having a meeting recently with someone, and the topic of, you know, Taiwan and China, and, you know, obviously the sensitivity of potential invasion of, you know, Taiwan by China, which is certainly not our view at all. I think it's highly unlikely, if not never going to happen. That's pretty much moved out of the front and center of the press, because we've got other geopolitical hotspots. You know, you've got what's happening in the Middle East at the moment. You've had the Russia-Ukraine invasion. So The rhetoric around the geopolitics of China with respect to the West is just a function of what people want to hear at a moment in time, because there maybe isn't anything else to write about. And geopolitics never goes away. If you are an investor and you want to allocate capital and you're always worrying about the next geopolitical hotspot, you'll never allocate money, because there's always somewhere. So our view is, let's just go to the fundamentals of investing, look at valuations, look at economic activity, look at monetary policy, fiscal policy, and then form a view. Geopolitical, you know, commentary will always be in or out of favor at any given moment in time.
Well, anything else an investor should be looking at? Because you mentioned earlier AI, you mentioned cybersecurity.
Yeah, I mean, obviously AI has been a very important topic with the likes of NVIDIA, who I think are reporting today. So it's, you know, that's one of the bellwether names to watch in the AI space. And, you know, we've invested, you know, indirectly using ETFs into the whole sort of semiconductor space. And we follow AI, and in one of our particular funds, we have exposure to AI. So it's very much front and center. I think valuations, you know, imply that the market is expecting exceptional returns from AI-related businesses to continue for a long time. And one should perhaps have a little bit of caution because although the growth might be stellar, it might not be as good as expected. And so you could still see disappointment in terms of stock price performance. So, you know, one has to balance off the secular trend of AI and the move towards, you know, AI in general over the next decade or two and the future of, you know, how humans do business and all sorts of things on the planet versus what's priced in today. Because I think a lot of the success of companies like NVIDIA has been front-end loaded to a degree by big tech companies that have bought and wanted to be leaders in a particular area of AI and therefore bought NVIDIA's, you know, GPU. So it's a very fine balancing act on what's the right valuation and potential growth. So, you know, you definitely want to have some exposure, but I wouldn't bet the house on it, in summary. In terms of other themes, you know, obviously cybersecurity, we think is a long-term secular theme that's very important. You know, in today's day and age where you've got a digital world, and more people are going online, you're going to need more cyber protection. You know, the fraudsters are getting cleverer and cleverer. And so you need cyber. It's not going away. You know, in terms of clean energy, you know, although, you know, there was a lot of perhaps overvaluation and froth in sort of solar and wind companies, there's no doubt that the world will continue to move towards a greener world, you know, with all the various 2040, 2050 targets. So it's a secular theme. You need to have some exposure, and there are different ways to get that exposure. You know, are you looking at solar? Are you looking at wind? Are you looking at, you know, the battery value chain, for example? Are you looking at electric vehicles? There are lots of different ways in which you can get that exposure in a portfolio. So those are all themes we watch quite closely.
Mark Birchall from Onboard, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thanks, Linda.